Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover in this audio Psalms chapter 22, which I will entitle, My God, My God, Why Have You Forsaken Me? Those words should sound familiar to the average Christian. The heading of the psalm is this, For the Director of Music to the Tune of the Doe of the Morning, a Psalm of David. That's the NASB translation of the heading. The ESV has the Doe of the Dawn, which I think is a little bit better because of the alliteration. Now, what does Doe of the Dawn mean? Well, it could be the name of the tune to which this psalm was set. The psalm was for the director of music, the choir master, the choir director. And so this was a psalm to be sung by human voices, and perhaps that's what it means. In fact, that's the way the translation, the NASB, has it, to the tune of the Doe of the Morning. Jameson Fawcett and Brown list that as an option. Also another option, the Doe of the Morning could be the name of a musical instrument. Another option, says Jameson Fawcett and Brown, the Doe of the Morning could be an expression concerning the subject of the psalm. The doe is pursued by hunters, even as David is pursued. A doe is a meek and innocent sufferer, just like David is a meek and innocent sufferer. The doe obtained relief in the morning, as David soon will. Well, all of that's nice speculation. Verse 1, my God, why have you forsaken me? Of course, Jesus quoted this psalm while he hung on the cross. In Matthew 27, verse 46, about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. That's the Aramaic, and Matthew conveniently translates that for his readers. That is, my God, why have you forsaken me? We instantly have a theological problem when we think about this in the terms of Jesus. How could God the Father forsake God the Son? Well, here's two possibilities. First possibility is that Jesus, in his human nature, was not really abandoned or forsaken by God. He just felt like he was. It was not true that God had actually forsaken him. Now, backing that up is John Gill, who has a very good theological quote here. This forsakingness, this abandonment, quote, is to be understood not as if the hypostatical or personal union of the divine and human natures were dissolved, which of course would be impossible, or that the one was now separated from the other, for the fullness of the Godhead still dwelt bodily in him, nor that he ceased to be the object of the Father's love, for so he was in the midst of all his sufferings. Yea, his Father loved him, because he laid down his life for the sheep. This also cannot mean that the principle of joy and comfort was lost in Jesus, only the act and sense of it. He was now deprived of the gracious presence of God, of the manifestations of his love to his human soul, and had a sense of divine wrath, not for his own sins, but for the sins of the people, and was for a while destitute of help and comfort, all which were necessary in order to make satisfaction for sin. John Gill very fancily describes Jesus on the cross as bearing the sins of mankind, and as a result, God could not look at him. As a result, Jesus lost the conscious presence of God, and so he felt forsaken, in his human nature, of course. Now note that David was in the same situation as Jesus. David felt that God had abandoned him, but actually God had not abandoned him. He never abandons his children. And notice that David, to express that thought, that God never abandons his children, he says in verse 3 and 4, that's all right, God's got my back. In verse 3, he said, yet, God, you are holy. In verse 4, in you, God, our fathers trusted. They trusted and you delivered them. See, that doesn't sound like being abandoned, does it not? That doesn't sound like being forsaken. Verse 5, God, to you our fathers cried out and were delivered. In you, God, they trusted and were not disappointed. So David objectively knows that God has not abandoned him. He just feels like it. And I don't mean to poo-poo that. If you ever felt abandoned by God, as I have, and I bet every Christian on this earth has, it's not a pleasant experience. Well, there's another way to look concerning Jesus, about how God had forsaken Jesus. You could say God actually did abandon Jesus because Jesus was bearing sin, and a holy God cannot be in the presence of sin. However, if you do say that, you have to say the abandonment of the Son by the Father is God abandoning Jesus and Jesus' human nature. You could never say that God abandoned Jesus in his divine nature, because how can you divide the Trinity up, the Father and the Son, and say, whoop, they're not together anymore? That, of course, would be absurd. But I think the best way to look at this is that Jesus, in his human nature, feels abandoned by God because he's going to suffer everything that humans do in his humanity. David continues in verse 1, "Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning." What David means is, I'm groaning here, my deliverance is a long way from where my groaning is. God's not answering me as quickly as I would like him to. How many times have we felt that? The words of my groaning, we can see that David is in a bad shape here, as he often is, attacked by his enemies. That seems to be a constant theme of the Psalms as we read through them, as we read through the Davidic Psalms. And by the way, I forgot to mention, this is also a Davidic Psalm, as have all the Psalms from 2 up to here, 22, have been Davidic Psalms, all but number 1. "Far from my deliverance are the words of my groaning," the King James has, "my roaring." Jameson Fawcett Brown says that David's words, or the sounds that David is making, is the sound of the conduct of an irrational creature in pain, expressive of the depths of David's grief. God's Word translation has God's deliverance far from David's cries of anguish. So this is gut-wrenching pain that David is going through here. We go now to verse 2. "Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer." That is exactly what Job was saying. He was saying, "God, where are you? How come I can't get into your heavenly courtroom?" Of course, the answer is patience, or endurance, to use the modern language. You endure when God does not answer. And David is going to do just like Job did. He's going to endure. As we read the rest of the psalm, he's going to say, "I put my trust in God. He's going to deliver me eventually. But in the meantime, God, you're not answering me. And by night, I have no rest. I'm staying up all night, tossing and turning, because I don't see any defense from my enemies." But he doesn't complain too much. Job went much further than David did in complaining. David says in verse 3, "Yet you are holy." Holy, of course, means separated from the world, separated unto God in purity, righteousness, no sin. "Yet you are holy, O you who are enthroned upon the praises of Israel." That could mean just generally God is made king because Israel's praising him. He could have more specific reference to the tabernacle, because God lived in the Holy of Holies, more particularly in the ark where the law was. And of course, when the Shekinah glory filled the Holy of Holies, that's where God is living. And coming through the front door of the Holy of Holies is the smoke of the golden altar of incense, which of course is symbolic of the praises of Israel. And so the smoke of the golden altar goes into the tabernacle where God is, and so God is said to be enthroned upon the praises of Israel. David, very well, he's much more Jewish than we are. He could have meant that when he said that. Verse 4, David says, "In you our fathers trusted." Now, who were the fathers? That, of course, would be the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Some commentators speculate that David was at Mahanaim when he wrote this psalm. Mahanaim is the place where Jacob camped after he wrestled with the angel of the Lord at the Jabbok River on his way back from Syria. And David is saying, "Jacob, you had to wrestle with God for an answer. I'm doing the same thing. He's not answering me now, so I'm wrestling with him, looking for an answer." And David is saying in verse 4, "Jacob, you trusted, and you, our fathers, trusted. And Jacob, you trusted God, even though you had to wrestle with him." Well, that's a nice speculation. It's, of course, a speculation. Verse 5, David continues, "To you, God, they cried out and were delivered." The patriarchs were delivered. Now, if you think about the patriarchs and all the trouble they were in, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you could spend 2 or 3 hours basically giving the history of the Old Testament. Nothing but oppression by enemies, problems, you name it, even famines. How about Joseph? He ended up being a slave in Egypt. You could go on and on and on. And yet they survived, and they flourished, and they were prosperous, and they created a nation out of the wilderness, a nation in the midst of all the Canaanite nations who wanted to kill them. They were delivered. David says, "In you, God, the patriarchs trusted and were not disappointed." That was true as a matter of history. And David, of course, knew that history. We go now to Psalms 22, verses 6 through 8. David continues, "But I am a worm and not a man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip. They wag the head, saying, 'Commit yourself to the Lord. Let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, because he delights in him.'" In other words, let God deliver the afflicted person who is the reproach of men. Let God rescue the afflicted person, because God delights in that afflicted person, i.e. David. Now, David calls himself a worm. Now remember, of course, David is a type of Christ, and that typology is going to be very, very obvious in Psalm 22. And I'm going to give you a quote from John Gill, who says that this is Christ speaking of himself. Gill makes David almost disappear, and everything that David says applies to Christ. He's extreme on that. Most commentators don't make the type disappear like Gill does. So anyway, let's talk about how Jesus is speaking of himself. Is verse 6 talking about Jesus calling himself a worm? Well, now, Jesus wasn't a worm, was he? Of course not. So why does Jesus say he's a worm? The antitype of David. Why does the antitype of David, Jesus, say he is a worm? John Gill says this, quote, Christ calls himself a worm, not because of his original, for he was not of the earth earthy, but was the Lord from heaven. That should be not because of his origin. Little typo there. Christ calls himself a worm not because of his origin, for he was not of the earth earthy, but was the Lord from heaven, not because of his human nature, man being a worm and the Son of Man such, and because of his meanness and low estate in that nature and his humiliation. So it's not because of his origin, not because of his human nature that Jesus is a worm, nor is it to express his humility in the mean thoughts that Jesus had of himself. As David, his type, calls himself a dead dog and a flea. It's not because of Jesus' own approach to himself. Gill says, but the reason that Jesus was a worm was on account of the opinion that men of the world had of him. Well, if that's true of Jesus, it's also true of David. David was not a worm. He was speaking about himself here, in my opinion, contrary to Gill. When David says, I am a worm, he meant he was a worm. But does that mean that David had a low self-esteem? Calling himself a worm? No. David was not, objectively speaking, a worm. Why did he say he was a worm? Because he felt like a worm. His enemies were looking upon him as a worm. Or it could be one or the other of those two options. He either felt like a worm, or his enemies were looking upon him as a worm, or both. He felt like a worm, and his enemies looked at him as if he were a worm. Now, remember, David usually was very confident. After all, in many ways, he led a highly successful life. He had great military victories. At first, at least, he was a very successful king. And in fact, after all, we have the problem of David's self-righteousness in the Psalms. He says, I'm blameless before you, God. He didn't sound like he was a worm in many, many places in the Psalms. But this psalm was written in the midst of trouble for David, affliction for David. As the NIV Study Bible points out, David faced many difficulties, temptations, and sorrows, and this was one of those times, and that's why he felt like he was a worm. And also his enemies thought he was a worm. David says so in verse 6, I am a reproach of men and despised by the people. All who see me sneer at me. That's why he's a worm. People usually sneer at worms. Oh, look at that little creepy little worm down there on the earth. Well, one more brief note concerning, is David speaking of himself? Or is he speaking of Christ? Adam Clark takes my view and says that David is speaking of himself, not Jesus. Clark says this, quote, I can see no sense in which our Lord could use these terms. I am a worm. David might well use them to express his vileness and worthlessness, but not Jesus. So David says he is a reproach of men, despised by the people. Verse 7, all who see me sneer at me. They separate with the lip. You can see them baring their teeth, kind of like George C. Scott and Humphrey Bogart do in the movies. When they want to show scorn, they wag the head. Oh, you pitiful jerk. I can see somebody wagging the head. We do that sort of thing even today in our culture. Now, this wagging the head was quoted by Jesus when Jesus referred to those who were mocking Jesus on the cross. Matthew 27, verse 39. And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads. I say it was quoted by Jesus, quoted by Matthew, who was referring to Jesus. When did people wag their heads at David? Remember Shimei cursing David, throwing rocks at him as David was sadly leaving Jerusalem during Absalom's rebellion? That could be when this happened. Let's look at another use of that expression, wag the head. Lamentations 2:15, written by Jeremiah to lament the fall of Jerusalem in 586. After Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians, Lamentations 2:15 says this, all who pass along the way clap their hands in derision at you. They hiss and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. They shake their heads. We move now to verse 8. David says that those who are wagging the head at David and separating their lips at David are saying this, "Commit yourself to the Lord, David. Let the Lord deliver you. Let God deliver you, because God delights in you." You say God delights in you, well, then let him deliver you. Now, the verse actually used third-person pronouns him, but what they meant was you, David. And see, that's the problem when things go bad and God doesn't show up immediately, is people will start saying, what kind of God do you serve? And Moses had that same problem with the children of Israel. I think Job himself mentioned it one time, if my memory serves me correctly. It's people are going to start thinking, what kind of a God it is that I'm serving here that's letting me suffer like this? As a matter of fact, unbelieving Jews, observing Jesus hanging on the cross, said the same thing and quoted this psalm, Matthew 27, verse 43. He, referring to Jesus, he trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he delights in him. For he said, I am the Son of God. Well, the first part of that verse is a direct quotation of verse 8 in Psalms 22. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he delights in him. Psalm 22 is one of the most messianic psalms you're ever going to find. We go now to Psalms 22, verses 9 through 11. David continues his prayer to the Lord. Yet you, God, are he who brought me forth from the womb. You made me trust when upon my mother's breast. Upon you I was cast from birth. You have been my God from my mother's womb. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. David says, God, your relationship to me is just like the relationship with my mama. My mama brought me forth from the womb because she cared for me. My mama made me trust when I was upon her breast. A baby instinctively trusts for the milk he is about to receive from his mother's breast. And God, I instinctively trust you to give me help from my enemies. Verse 10, upon you, God, I was cast from birth. Even as a baby instinctively trusts his mother for milk, picture, if you will, that mother taking that baby and throwing that baby up into God's hands. Soon as he was born, the parents devoted David to God. The NIV Study Bible says because of that, David had apparently been raised well by godly parents. That's probably what he meant. I was cast upon you as soon as I was born. I went from my mother's breast as soon as I could understand anything. I was taught about God. David continues in verse 10, you have been my God from my mother's womb. As soon as I was born, I've loved you. And again, application point here. If you train your kids to love God, it's real hard for them to run permanently. Verse 11, David says to God, be not far from me, for trouble is near. There's none to help. There's no human beings to help. He doesn't have any allies. He needs God. He asked God, be not far from me. Since God has been so close ever since the beginning of David's life, God should be close now. Don't be far from me, God. You were with me from my mother's womb, so I need you now. We go to Psalms 22, verses 12 through 18. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They open wide their mouth at me as a ravening and a roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws, and you lay me in the dust of death. For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Verse 12, many bulls have surrounded me, strong bulls of Bashan. Where was Bashan? That was a very fruitful country, had lots of cattle of various sorts, was located to the east of the Sea of Galilee, i.e. the Golan Heights. In that area, it was noted for its fertility. Deuteronomy 32:14 says this, curds of cows and milk of a flock with fat of lambs and rams, the breed of Bashan, and goats with the finest of the wheat and of the blood of grapes you drank wine. So rams were particularly known as being from Bashan as being good rams. Adam Clark says the bull is the emblem of brutal strength that gores and tramples down all before it. And the NIV Study Bible says that this place, Bashan, east of the Sea of Galilee, in the tribe of half-Manasseh. That place, Bashan, was ideal for livestock. Bashan's well-fed bulls were famous for their size and apparently for their mean disposition. Well, anytime you get a bull that gets big, you can assume he's got a mean disposition. That's just the way bulls are. And so this is a great metaphor that David used to apply to his enemies. For example, Absalom and David's former official Ahithophel during Absalom's rebellion, they're bulls. They're bulls of Bashan, particularly big bulls, strong bulls. They've encircled David. Verse 13, they open wide their mouth at me, David says, as a ravening and a roaring lion. A little slight shift of metaphor from bulls to lion. Either way, you don't want to encounter one of those animals. Verse 14, David says, I am poured out like water. Water has very little intestinal fortitude. It has very little spine. It sort of just drains out on the ground and disappears, sinks into the ground. And that's what David says was happening to him. He says, all my bones are out of joint. Now, people who like to refer to Jesus here as the type of all this say that bones being out of joint could refer to Jesus on the cross. Maybe. I really don't like to take types as being types unless they are explicitly referred to in the New Testament, or unless the type is so obvious that you can't deny it. This is one of those 50-50 type types. My bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. Wax, of course, melts very fast. When the candle flame starts burning next to the wax, his heart is melted, a perfect metaphor of his fear. Verse 15, David says, my strength is dried up like a potsherd. A potsherd, of course, is a broken pottery fragment. It has no use. It has no strength. My tongue cleaves to my jaws. That would be a dry mouth, which happens, of course, when you get afraid. Your mouth dries up. Your tongue cleaves to your jaws. And David says, and you lay me in the dust of death. That's getting Job-like there. God, you are laying me in the dust of death, because David knows that God is sovereign. He could stop all the bulls of Bashan from hurting David, but God doesn't do it. And so David is saying, God, you're putting me in the grave, in the dust of death. Verse 16, David continues, for dogs have surrounded me. Now remember, when David talks about dogs, he's not talking about Fido or Peaches. He's talking about these mean junkyard dogs, the type of dogs that chase me on my bicycle while I'm trying to get exercise with their lips bared back from their teeth. Ah! Junkyard dogs. They have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. And again, those who want to say this is referring to Jesus say that this happened to Jesus because he had his feet pierced. Now, David never did have his feet pierced, so he is obviously talking here metaphorically. And his hands, he says his hands were pierced. He's never had that happen. But it did happen to Christ. So that makes an argument for people like John Gill, who are emphasizing the fact that David is a type and Jesus is the antitype. And as John Gill says, the whole psalm is referring to Christ. We could also point out in verse 18, which we're getting to in a minute, David says, they divide my garments among them. That never happened to David. It happened to Jesus, though. Well, I don't deny that this psalm is prophetic, and that all these events, the dividing of garments, the piercing of the hands and feet, is typological, because that's obvious. But just because that's typological, I wouldn't want to go further than that and say that every detail of the psalm is about Jesus and not about David. Now, just because it didn't happen to Christ doesn't mean it's not referring to David. As the NIV Study Bible says, David made poetic allusions to what was happening to him poetically, not actually, but God took that poetry that David wrote and he used it to foreshadow Christ being nailed to the cross. And I think the NIV Study Bible is right on there. The NIV Study Bible says that the poetic references to dogs biting David's hands and feet, because he's just mentioned dogs, those junkyard dogs, and that's what dogs like to do. They like to bite you. And so, in fact, it says in verse 16, dogs have surrounded me, a band of evildoers has encompassed me, the reference to that could be a band of evildoers, but the band of evildoers were just compared to dogs, and so David could be thinking about dogs who have pierced his hands and feet, and I think that's exactly what he was doing. The NIV Study Bible also says here that we really don't know how David had his hands and feet pierced. It's just speculation that it's poetry. Jameson Fawcett Brown makes the point that this verse is never quoted in the New Testament. The events are just recorded, and the events seem to track pretty well what David has talked about here in the psalm. His enemies circle David and they look and they stare at him. They stared at him either in tragic pity or they stare at him because they're licking their chops waiting to see him go down. In verse 17, David says, I can count all my bones. That could refer to Jesus on the cross because crucifixion, of course, extends the bones as the crucified person extends his chest in order to get air in it, because if he doesn't, he will suffocate. And so as he extends his chest, his bones are accentuated. Or David might be referring to the hunger he's experiencing as he is being attacked. We go now to Psalm 22, verses 19 through 24. But you, O Lord, David continues, but you, O Lord, be not far off. O you, my help, hasten to my assistance. Deliver my soul from the sword, my only life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the wild oxen, you answer me. David likes to use animal metaphors. He's talked about dogs, wild, nasty dogs, lions, bulls, and I guess bulls would be the same thing as a wild oxen. From the horns of the wild oxen, you answer me. Verse 22, I will tell of your name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly. I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. David switches from addressing God directly. Now he's looking at the people in his audience, whoever they may be. Verse 23, you who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, glorify him. And stand in awe of him, all you descendants of Israel. For he is not despised, nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, nor has he hidden his face from him. But when he cried to him for help, he heard. So in verse 19, David says, but you, O Lord, be not far off. Now, if you think about it, God wasn't far off. He was right there because God's omnipresent. But to David, he seemed like he was far off. To David, it seemed like God was a long, long, long way away. Remember, he says, my God, why have you forsaken me in verse 1? He wasn't, but David felt like he was. O you, my help, hasten to my assistance, David said, verse 20, deliver my soul from the sword. Now, the King James has got a great translation here. Verse 20 in the KJV says this, deliver my darling from the sword. My darling? This, my friends, is one of the two verses that one should use in order to get people to quit using the KJV as their normal day-to-day Bible. I mean, I use the KJV. Well, sometimes the translations are actually better than the modern ones every now and then. But to use it as your normal translation? King James English is not our language. It's a dialect. Why would you use dialect instead of your native language, English? Deliver my darling from the sword. Sounds like you're delivering Pauline in the perils of Pauline. You're delivering a woman from a sword about to get killed, and you're in love with her, my darling. The other King James verse that I love to use is, he that pisseth against the wall. And I tell people, are you going to give your kids a Bible that uses a coarse word like that in the Holy Scriptures? Well, enough of that. David says, deliver my only life from the power of the dog. In the last part of verse 20, the power of the nasty, evil dogs, the junkyard dogs, of course. Verse 21, save me from the lion's mouth, from the horns of the wild oxen. The mouth is where the lion has his strength. The horns is where the wild oxen has his strength. His enemies are strong. He's acknowledging that, so I need your help, God. Verse 22, I will tell of your name to my brethren in the midst of the assembly. I will praise you. This is referring to when Israelites gathered together for public worship. I assume it's in front of the tabernacle, David's tabernacle in Jerusalem. Verse 23, you who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, glorify him and stand in awe of him. All you descendants of Israel, David is praising this God who he says is far away. He has not forgotten God. He's not come to the belief that God has abandoned him. Notice that Jacob is in parallel with Israel. All you descendants of Jacob, all you descendants of Israel. Because Jacob is just another word for Israel. Israel got named by the patriarch Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob. Jacob meant deceiver, and then God changed his name to Israel, which means he struggles with God, i.e. at the Jabbok River near Mahanaim. So stand in awe of God, all of Israel, for he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. In verse 24, afflicted is often translated poor. I think the Hebrew word has a hard time getting translated into English. I think it's because oftentimes the poor are afflicted, and so therefore you have sort of a overlap of the semantic feel. God has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted. David's saying it's bad. It looks bad for me now, but God's never failed the patriarchs. He's not going to fail me. Nor has God hidden his face from the afflicted person. But when the afflicted person cried to God for help, he heard, as David knows from the history of Israel. Before I move on to verse 25, let me go back to the KJV translation. In verse 21, when David says that God has answered him, given him help, from the horns of the wild oxen, the King James has from the horns of unicorns. Unicorns? They don't even exist. At least I've never seen one. But the King James puts unicorns in the translation, which is absurd. or at least it's observed in modern day English. And yet there are people out there who are not only using the King James English, but they are saying that is a sin if I don't use it. The KJV only cult? No. Please, let's be reasonable here. Let's don't be silly. Psalms 22, verses 25 through 29. From you comes my praise in the great assembly. I shall pay my vows before those who fear him. David continues his prayer to God in this musical psalm. He says in verse 25, from you, God, comes my praise in the great assembly. I shall pay my vows before those who fear him, who fear God. The afflicted will eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him will praise the Lord. Let your heart live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will worship before you. For the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. All those who go down to the dust will bow before him, even he who cannot keep his soul alive. Now in verse 25, David says, I am praising you, God, in the great assembly. What's the great assembly? Is that just an assembly this big? There are two options here. One option is mentioned by Adam Clark that the great assembly is referring to the Gentiles, whereas the congregation in verse 22 that we just talked about referred to Jews. Well, obviously, in verse 22, David says, I will tell of your name to my brethren, his Jewish brethren, in the midst of the assembly or the congregation. That's referring to the Jewish assembly. And so the idea here is when David talks about the great assembly, he's not referring to the Jewish assembly, but he's talking about the bigger assembly of people who are spread out all over the world in the form of the Gentiles. Now, supporting that idea is that David immediately says in verse 27, all the ends of the earth, that sounds like the Gentiles, and at the end of verse 27, and all the families of the nations, well, that certainly sounds like the Gentiles. Verse 28, God rules over the nations, that's the Gentiles. Verse 29, all the prosperous of the earth, well, that could be land, but I think the context here is the earth. All the prosperous of the earth, that's talking about Gentiles. Well, the other option is that David is just talking still, as he was in verse 22. In verse 25, he's still talking about the Jewish assembly, and I tend to think that's true. And then I think he switches to the Gentiles when he gets down to verse 27. Matthew Poole says it could go either way. He says this, that David is singing his praise, quote, either in the general assemblies of the Israelites at their solemn feast, or in the universal church made up of Jews and Gentiles, as the following verses explain it. So that's similar to what I said. It's a combination of the Gentiles and Jews. It's not just the Gentiles that the great assembly may refer to. In verse 26, David says, the afflicted will eat and be satisfied. He's ending his psalms up, as he always does, on a positive note. The afflicted, of course, can be poor. The NIV, the KJV, translates that as poor. The poor will eat and be satisfied. The greatest desire of a poor man's heart is to eat. They'll eat and be satisfied. And they will be satisfied by the Lord. Because in verse 26, David says, those who seek him will praise the Lord. Let your heart live forever. It's the Lord who's going to let the poor or the afflicted eat and be satisfied. Let your heart live forever. As I have said many, many times in previous audios, forever can either mean world without end, with every second being included, both past and present. Here it would be every second all the way up to the future, eternal. Well, if David is referring to the afflicted who live forever eternally, I guess he would have to be referring to their post-temporal life. But I think that we need to take the other definition of the word forever. I assume that's Olam. I didn't look it up. But there's another definition of forever, which is a long, long time. Long, long time, we're going to eat and be satisfied. The afflicted will. Verse 27, all the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord. Now, Adam Clark says that here is a prophecy that the gospel was to cover the whole earth. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord. Will remember what? Well, here are some options as to what will be remembered by the Gentile nations. All the ends of the earth, that's the Gentile nations now. What will they remember? Option number one, they will remember all the gracious words and glorious works of Christ, as Benson suggests. Or they will remember the Gentiles' former wickedness with grief, shame, and fear, Benson suggests. Or option number three, the Gentiles will remember their great and manifold obligations to God, as Benson suggests. The Cambridge Commentary suggests option number 4, the Gentiles will remember the workings of God on the conscience. Here's option number 5 from the Pulpit Commentary and from the Barnes Commentary. The Gentiles will simply remember that Yahweh himself is the true God. They will remember Yahweh as the true God. At the end of verse 27, David says, "And all the families of the nations will worship before you, God." Families of the nations, that means families of the Gentiles. That's what nations means. So we see here that God's salvation was not just limited to the Jews, as we've been pointing out in these several verses here. The ends of the earth, the nations. Now, I think that verse is interesting considering the big problem that the New Testament apostles like Paul had in trying to convince the Jews, Peter too, had trying to convince the Jews that the gospel was universal, not just particular for the Jews. Well, it's even in the Old Testament. David very clearly here is talking about salvation for everybody, not just the Jews, over the whole nations, over the whole world. Verse 29, David says, "All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. All those who go down to the dust will bow before him." So David is making a contrast from people who are successful and wealthy and highfalutin, as opposed to those who go down to the dust and who are buried in the grave. Those who are pretty abject. Big contrast there. It doesn't matter whether you're up or whether you're down. Everybody's going to worship God. All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. Now that's interesting. All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. Well, what this is referring to is verse 26, where the poor and the afflicted are said to eat and be satisfied. The prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. This means, David means, is that the poor and the rich are all going to eat together in a banquet, and they're going to worship. I like that idea of eating connected with worship. Sounds like the Lord's Supper. Sounds like Moses on the top of Mount Sinai eating that meal with the elders of Israel. So this is a typical meme, if you will, in the scriptures. Eating is associated with rejoicing in the presence of God. Many will come from the north and south and eat with Abraham. Recall what Jesus said. Now, a little side note here in verse 29. All the prosperous of the earth will eat. In my previous, or maybe in several audios previous, I went into a long rant about the two extremes that people can take concerning material financial prosperity. There are those who think that if you're not rich, you're sinful, and there are those who think that if you are rich, you're sinful. The latter being these sojourner types, leftist evangelicals, Marxist evangelicals like Jim Wallace. Well, just to point out here, David doesn't say there's anything wrong with being prosperous. All the prosperous of the earth will eat and worship. They're going to be in the presence of God. There's nothing wrong with being rich. Now, the Bible often has instances where rich people are condemned for doing sinful things. For example, in the book of James, the Bible never condemns somebody just for being rich. Abraham was filthy rich. Jesus and Paul, on the other hand, were poor. One's bank account does not determine your spirituality. I think that's a great application to make in present-day America because we are eaten up with the love of money. And on the other hand, these left-wing evangelical Christians, perhaps in reaction to Americans' wealth fetish, they perhaps go too far the other extreme. We need to strike a steady path right down the middle of those two extremes. So David finishes verse 29, "All those who go down to the dust will bow down before God." Go down to the dust means they die and go into the grave. "Even he who cannot keep his soul alive." And the question is how can dead people worship God? Well, it could mean that David is assuming that they will bow before God after they're resurrected, which would mean we have some evidence in the Old Testament of belief in life after death. Now, that's true that those who die will bow before God. Every knee shall bow and every tongue confess. But I'm not sure that's what David meant. He might have just been saying from high to low. In other words, he might have just been a little bit poetical, metaphoric. It's always hard to tell. We go down to verses 30 and 31, and we will finish this audio. David continues, and now he's switching from a direct address to God. He's addressing his audience in the third person. He says in verse 30, "Posterity will serve him. It will be told of the Lord to the coming generation. They will come and will declare his righteousness to a people who will be born, that he has performed it." How will posterity serve God? Well, the NIV Study Bible says David is referring to those Israelites who come after him, but Adam Clark and John Gill take it even further than that. They say David's posterity includes Christians, because Christians, of course, are the adopted seed of Jesus. The genealogy goes from David to Jesus and then Jesus to his children. I kind of think that Clark and Gill are right there, although, of course, David might not have known that. Of course, he didn't know it. He was referring to his own Jewish posterity. It will be told of the Lord to the coming generation. What will be told to the Lord? Well, let me switch from the NASB to the Holman Christian Study Bible translation here. The next generation will be told about the Lord. The NASB is the most confusing translation, except for the KJV, that I've ever read most of the time. The only reason I'm using it is because at the time I was making my notes, I didn't have access to the Holman Christian Study Bible. I was in China for a long time. I had software and so forth that didn't have the Holman Christian Study Bible or the ESV. So the next generation will be told about the Lord, David says. Well, now, what does next generation refer to? Does that refer to the generation right after David, one generation past David, the next generation? No. As Clark, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and John Gill all say, it refers to one generation, and then the next generation, and then the next generation, as one generation tells the next generation on and on and on forever. You can read it both ways. Well, that makes more sense to me. He's talking about all the generations will be told about the Lord. And, of course, that's what's happened today. The descendants of David, the Christians, are now all over the world. Of Jesus' kingdom, there will be no end. David prophesied that in his psalm, and, of course, his Psalm 22, which has a bunch of sadness in it, at the beginning ends on a very uplifted, positive, and cheerful note. And I pointed out to you that David likes to write his psalms that way. Ladies and gentlemen, we're now prepared to go to Psalm 23 in our next audio. The Lord is my shepherd. And of course, many of you have probably already memorized that psalm. I never sat down to memorize it, but I can almost say it from memory because I've heard it so many times. It's only 6 verses long. We'll look at that next. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.